time once again for Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning Dr. Quentin Young. Dr. Quentin Young is an internist who recently retired from a decades-long practice in the Hyde Park community of Chicago's South Side. He is clinical professor of preventative medicine and community health at the University of Illinois Medical Center. He was a founder and served as national chairman of the Medical Committee for Human Rights, which was formed in June 1964, to provide medical care for civil rights workers, community activists, and summer volunteers working in Mississippi during Freedom Summer. He and MCHR also volunteered and helped set up Black Panthers and Young Lords health clinics and provided emergency medical care to protesters at the 1968 Democratic National Convention in Chicago. During the 1970s and early 80s, he served as chairman of the Department of Internal Medicine at Cook County, where he established the Department of Occupational Medicine. And he is currently the national coordinator of physicians for a national health program. Dr. Young, thank you very much for coming and spending time with us this morning.
A pleasure being with you. Thank you.
So start out, tell us, how did you get involved in medicine?
Well, it started quite young, actually. I started thinking of careers when I was in high school and when I attended the University of Chicago as an undergraduate. And I picked medicine, we're talking 1940s. Because it was seemed to me a profession where you didn't have to be bad. And by bad, I mean exploiting people, taking advantage of them in the numerous ways that professionals can. You obviously can, and many did exploit their physician role, but you didn't have to. And you could make a decent living and have a public role as a citizen and still be helping people. That's the way it looked to me, and I'm sort of think it's been vindicated in the subsequent 60 years.
And can you talk about how you came to founding the Medical Committee for Human Rights?
Well, it was the medical arm of the civil rights movement, and I'm sure many of your listeners know what a dynamic that was in the 50s and 60s of the last century. We had a civil war to end slavery, but we certainly didn't end discrimination. And legally in the South and just by custom in the North, blacks were excluded from everyday life. Places to eat were forbidden them in the South and to a certain extent in the North. They had inferior jobs. And while slavery was no longer legal, we admit that, the plight of people of color was really grim. And in many attempts to rectify it over the years following the Civil War, but only in the late 50s and early 60s the movement, and I use that word movement very judiciously, it's a very important word. Certainly blacks and people who sympathize with them hated slavery and wished it would come to an end, but until it became a movement and literally thousands of people across the nation were willing to confront the evil, that it became something that was going to be changed. And that, at long last, to answer your question, is when the Medical Committee for Human Rights was founded and developed into the medical arm of the civil rights movement. What does that mean? It meant that we had doctors and nurses, volunteers, who went down to the South where they had demonstrations. We were in the response to the movement that Dr. Martin Luther King subsequently led. And we shared, to a certain extent, the kind of oppression that the blacks who chose to demonstrate for their rights experienced. We were there to give medical aid where needed, and not infrequently was needed. People were injured in the confrontation. They were nonviolent. That was one of the principles of the civil rights movement that Dr. King established. And the movement, as I'm sure you know, grew and gained more and more national attention and support. And I guess the turning point was the bridge in Selma, Alabama. And they were beaten as they attempted to make a march toward Birmingham, the capital. And, the rest is history. The nation did change its mind about the second-class citizenship for people of color. And, we had a victory for the civil rights movement. The price was dear. I remind you, if you need reminding, that it meant Dr. King gave his life. He was assassinated, murdered in the city of Memphis where he was working, and many similar tragedies before victory was won, but that was what the medical committee did. But it's an interesting footnote just at this point. The black movement in the South politely in a friendly way said, why don't you do something about your cities in the North? They don't have the same legal discrimination that we experience here in the South, but there's many segregated and other kinds of punishments for people of color. Why don't you work in your own community? Think a minute, that's a much more serious thing. It's creative and to be commended that people took 2, 4, 6 weeks in South and helped the movement by medical support. But that doesn't begin to rival working in your own city, my city of Chicago, for example. Incidentally, we had very serious segregation in our hospitals in the city of Chicago. And we discovered a very novel way to expose that and end it, because it was illegal. But the people who ran the hospital said, oh, we don't have any discrimination at all. We never inquire as to the race of a patient. Well, we were able, through the device of getting birth and death certificates, which are indicate the race of the patient and the hospital. We were interested in hospital admissions. And we asked the then Commissioner of Health in Chicago, Dr. Bundison, who was had a national, earned reputation nationally as a public health man. And we sought and got an appointment with him, and we wanted him to give us the births and death certificates of people who died in hospitals or were born in hospitals. And to make a long story short, it unequivocally showed that if you were black and you were born in Chicago, you were born at Cook County Hospital, a public hospital, 85%, and maybe another 10% at the one so-called black hospital. And a handful of people would be born in other hospitals. Cynics said these were mothers who delivered in the emergency room before they could bar them from being there. And that discovery and those data changed the situation in Chicago favorably. That is to say, the city council passed laws that made it illegal to inquire the race of a patient if you weren't going to admit them to the hospital, or indeed the race of a patient who is going to be born in that hospital. So it takes a little ingenuity, but it's a very good cause, and people who participated felt very good about it.
You were also involved with helping to set up community clinics for the Black Panthers and the Young Lords.
Well, and many others. They were certainly part of the constituency. There was a very big free clinic movement in the late 50s and all through the 60s, even into the 70s. It was a novel and important way of confronting the fact that people didn't have the money to pay for the hospital bill. People who didn't enjoy health insurance in their job or independently had to pay first dollar and last dollar out of their pocket. And then, as now, medical bills were a major cause of bankruptcy. And you can be certain that the void was worse in the communities where Hispanics and immigrants and people of color, black people, lived. And so it was a very honorable period for American medicine. There were literally scores of clinics across the country. Now, I hasten to point out what your listeners probably note, equipment that was costly and the ability to do full range of diagnostic tests wasn't there. But these clinics were there to give primary care, and where the patient was seriously ill, send them to the emergency room. So they made some difference in the health care opportunities of the underprivileged. And a lot of American doctors had a rich experience that they wouldn't get in any other way working in these free clinics.
It seems like with the state of our health care here in the U.S. now, until organizations like yours help us to bring single-payer health care to us, that maybe community clinics might be a good stepping stone to return to.
Well, certainly it's good to have communities involved in meeting their health needs. And you've mentioned single payer. That's what we're for, and I want to make sure your listeners understand it. The simplest way to describe it is improved Medicare for all. Improved means that Medicare is very good, but it has some elements that make it less than it can be. For example, the copays and deductibles that Medicare beneficiaries have to pay don't mean too much in terms of cost to wealthy beneficiaries. But if you're a poor elderly person, that $10 copay or that $100 deductible before your insurance kicks in can be a very inhibiting factor. So when we talk about single payer, we should define it as improved Medicare for all. And all means all. Everybody in the country is covered. And there's no inquiry as to your social or economic status when you present for care. The idea is to treat people at the earliest possible time and take advantage of the enormous healthcare resources we have in this country. And we have them. We have highly technical machines. We have well-trained doctors and nurses. But we also have 50 million people without insurance. That doesn't mean they don't get care, but it means they come into the emergency room quite ill, and the outcome is always poorer if you delay care. And so that's what we're up to create a situation that, ironically, the rest of the world that resembles us enjoy. By resemble us, I mean countries that have an industrial economic system, as we do, and have a political system that's democratic. 20 nations fit that definition. 19 of them have adopted some form of single payer, and the 19 includes Western Europe, France, Scandinavia. Britain has actually a socialized system, and I'm not talking about a socialized system, but it certainly has reformed its system. Canada, our neighbor to the north, has a marvelously effective system, and it's pitiful that despite our closeness and friendship with that nation, there's so many misunderstandings about the Canadian health system. And then, interestingly enough, emerging countries in Asia, like Taiwan, Korea, have elegant systems. And when I say elegant, I'm talking about outcomes. Life expectancy in all these other 19 countries longer than ours. Freedom or access to treatment for preventable disease better than ours. On a scale that takes all the public health measures of health status, the United States is not first, second, third, or fifth. We are 37th in the world. And in fact, in all everything except cost, we're way down the list. And we now spend, just to bore your listeners with a little statistics, we spend twice as much per capita for the people in this country as the other 19 countries spend. In dollars, it's about $10,000 per year per person, even though 50 million people have no insurance. But factoring them in, we come out with an average of about 10 grand for every person in this country, as compared to 5,000 on average for the other 19, with better results. How long Americans are going to put up with this inequity, I don't know. Part of it is misinformation. It's startling in a free society how much confusion and distortion of what the real facts are. And my optimism about this reform being enacted in the foreseeable future is based on the fact that it isn't a health issue. I wish it were. It's rather the economic issue. We're in a serious recession now. Maybe we're coming out of it. But the facts are that the prosperity that characterized American livelihood for the last 100 years, each generation doing better than their parents, that's over. And one of the biggest causes for this complication is high cost of health care. Now, in my professional lifetime, which is some 60 years, in the last 20 years, there's been a startling and dangerous transformation. The control of health care slipped out of the hands of doctors and the American Medical Association, which was once much more powerful, not necessarily in the good way, but that's over. The power in medicine is in the hands of huge corporations that deal in tens of billions of dollars, pay their executives tens of millions of dollars, and do everything they can to ensure the profit, and that's achieved by, ironically, by selecting, if you can, healthy people and excluding sick people, the people who need your services. And then that's reflected in American statistics. Life expectancy is 3 or 4 years less than the other countries I mentioned. And we have many cruel deaths based on the fact that people don't have health insurance. The Medicare system, you notice I said improved Medicare, and that's because the Medicare system can be improved and better than it is, but that should never, and we must never lose sight that for seniors in our country, people 65 and older who get Medicare with no means test, you're 65, you get it. And when you, what you get is an important step toward good health care. I say improved because where we are now is not where we want to be. We still have co-pays and deductibles that are very, very burdensome for many old people. Incidentally, the other sector that is covered by the insurance law is people who are totally disabled. And you would obviously imagine they have huge health needs, and they do. So the system, so to speak, gave responsibility for the elderly, who are by definition more prone to disease, and the totally disabled, gave the most difficult sectors in the population. And happily, these two groups are protected. But what about the other 250 million of us? If you can get where you're employed, but even that is diminishing. Employees are trying to get out from under the ever-rising costs of health care. And that's the characteristic of our health care system. Every year, we have double-digit increases in the premium and more people not getting what they need. I can report to you and your listeners that the future is not as bleak as it was just 2 or 3 years ago. When Congress enacted a health reform, Senator Baucus, who was head of the committee that had control, Senator Baucus said, and I even at this moment, I find it hard to believe that he would say this. He said, everything is on the table except single payer. Now, in a democratic society, would your legislature say it? It might even be true, be concealed, but so arrogant are these people who are in the control of the health system. And let's talk about it a little bit. It's 18% of the whole GDP, whole gross domestic product. In dollars, $2.7 trillion. I already told you it averages $10,000 for every person in the country. Now, this is big, and this is decisive. This is no sideshow, and you know, that doesn't really affect the economy. It affects it mortally. And I would argue that that's the main reason we're going to move in that direction. Several states have taken the initial steps, and they're the vanguard of what we hope will be a national movement. And let me spend a moment on what I mean by movement. Ideas that have come to fruition and come to decision. In this country, it was slavery in the 1800s, and we had a cruel civil war before it was finally settled. But, you know, people have been against slavery since it was introduced in the 1600s. But it was never decisive, and our country was founded. If you look at the Constitution, you'll see actual provision for slavery. It's nothing to be proud of. And it became incompatible with the prosperity and survival and eloquence of this country. And as we all know, we had a bitter civil war, which finally the North prevailed, and slavery was illegal. It was abolished, which is good. But we went from it being a popular idea to being a movement. A movement is something that changes things. In the ensuing decades, we had women's suffrage, we had workmen's compensation, worker health, and we had anti-war movements that moved from popular acceptance to a movement stage. There's a difference in strength, and I believe we're in just such an environment today in health. It's our proposal, national health insurance, is supported in every poll that you take of the American people. And very interesting, and I'm very pleased with this, doctors who are a very conservative bunch now 59% of doctors last year said yes to the question, would you support a federal government tax to create a health insurance for every person in the country? 59% of doctors said yes. And why have doctors changed from conservative to a much more open idea? And it's because of the experience they've had with the corporations. The corporations have brutalized doctors and taken away the authority that they find necessary to give decent care. And I know I'm giving a long speech, but I feel I want to set the stage for the coming years, and we can go into the states where we're making progress, if you wish.
Yeah, talk about that. So you seek the end goal of having a national plan,
yes,
via the different states enacting their own plan, single payer?
That's very American. People don't really know that things like working conditions, minimum wage, it starts in this country in one or two of the states, and it's so successful that the federal government enacts it. And so with the single payer movement, we think, and to report to you and your audience where we are in that, where there was nothing really tangible 3 or 4 years ago, we now have 3 states that are getting very close to enacting it in a hostile environment. You can bet that the insurance companies is literally spending millions of dollars in advertisements and talk shows and a variety of ways they have to control public opinion. And the sum of public opinion is discouraging because it just doesn't go with the facts. The single-payer idea itself is demonized in the political debate, and no one challenges them. But that's changing. And to name the states that are moving along and to me are the hope of the future, first there's Vermont. Interesting state. It's a small state, to be sure, but very independent. And the recent elections elected both the governor and both houses came down on the side of a single-payer commitment. And they did enact certain legislation that facilitates single-payer. Not establishes it, but takes the necessary steps. Another state that is going in the same direction is California, your neighbor to the south. California, when Schwarzenegger was the governor and was sure to veto it, the legislature 3 times passed single-payer legislation, and yes, Schwarzenegger vetoed it. Now he's out of office, of course, and they have a liberal Democrat, Mr. Brown, former Governor Brown, got reelected this period, and they have, as you well know, serious financial problems like many states these days, and what I'm saying now is my interpretation. I have any proof, but I think Governor Brown doesn't want to deal with a massive item like single payer for the whole state of California. And not in a public way, but has passed the word that he'd like it not to be passed now. And to get to the point, about 2 weeks ago, the legislature didn't oppose it, but the necessary majority were what left the floor. So they only had 19 votes where they needed 21. And so for this, the people in California are going to have to work hard to convince the governor and the people who were sponsors of the bill who walked off the floor so they wouldn't give the necessary majority. So I'm very optimistic about California. I was just down there and they've had an education. And the last, state that's in play, surprisingly, is Hawaii. They have always been favorable towards single payer, and they've elected a governor who was in the Congress where he was a sponsor of the single payer bill. So I would like you to keep your eye on those 3 states. There are others, perhaps as many as 20, like my own state of Illinois, where people are supporting single-payer, but nothing like imminent passage as in the 3 states I enumerated. So that's the state of the nation, and I believe the real-life economy and the need for people to have health care without going bankrupt is going to be decisive. It's obviously a political question. You're going to have to elect people who say, I'm going to support that, and defeat those who refuse to do so.
So do you see that there's the money available to make this switch? Yeah.
Well, I appreciate the question, but if you think about it, the money is there. We're spending it now, and we're spending twice per capita of any other nation in the world. So this is one social problem where the resources are there. We don't have to forego one thing to make it happen. If we use these dollars wisely, we would immediately go up the ladder from 37, I would say, to number one, certainly in the first 10 at least, with just putting it together. There's some ominous trends that's worth mentioning. And for example, the normal ratio of primary care doctors to specialists is about 70 primary care to 30 specialists. And that's based on demand and need. And we enjoyed that ratio up until a few years ago. But the economics of healthcare is such that medical students come out of their training with a $200,000 debt, imagine, and they are, to a large extent, forced into the more lucrative specialties, surgical specialties, dermatology. These are all much better rewarded. And as we are talking now, there's a serious void in people in training to be primary care doctors. No, you know, it doesn't sound bad as I say it here, but that could create a crisis when there's literally no point of entry. The specialists are very important, but if you have more specialists than primary care doctors, you're going to have unnecessary procedures, and most important, you won't get primary care. So that's accelerating the problem, and it's going on as we speak. If you inspect the annual enrollment of doctors in training, they're all going into the specialists. All is an exaggeration, but a big increase. And primary care, let me inform your listeners what the primary care is. It's internists, general internists. It's pediatricians. It's some OB-GYN and family practice. That's the cohort that we would describe as primary care. And that should be 70% of trainees and 70% of doctors. It isn't. It's declining sharply, well under 50%. So we have byproducts of this monetary system in healthcare that can create real problems for us down the road. And I think as the public becomes aware of these other ills, there'll be more political will to have a system that's balanced. We should pay our primary care doctors more and possibly pay somewhat less to our specialists. I don't mean they should starve. They probably will always earn more than primary care doctors. But the 3-to-1 ratio that we experience today is hazardous.
Only about a minute left. So you are still optimistic. I mean, despite the changes, for instance, in corporations appearing to have a stranglehold on so much, you still believe this can become a movement?
I do, and warn your listeners, I've been criticized for being too optimistic, but I really think the political realities are dictating this change will come. Not only do we have the prior example of some 19 other countries that resemble us, that have similar problems and opportunities as we do, and they've all gone that route. And in every one of these countries, whether you're talking about France or Canada or what have you, the people like it. And they have a huge fear of a disease associated with age and associated with exposure to disease. And people like to be free. They like to have health care when they need it and not be worried that they're going to go broke. So I believe the politics of it is in our direction. What'll happen depends on whether we transform from a popular idea and become a movement, as the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement. I believe it's going to happen, and the choice for American people will become increasingly clear.
All right. Well, I want to thank you very much for coming in and spending time with us this morning.
My pleasure. Thank you.